Canceling plans because your knees hurt? Nope, not anymore. Get to Joint Relief Institute. Safe, fast, immediate pain relief covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Minutes past 8 o'clock, Phil Minnick in for John Records Landecker and 720 WGN. His photographs have graced the halls just about every radio station here in Chicago. He's captured Muddy Waters, the Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen, The Who, and Prince, just to scratch the surface. He's been at it for 45 years and counting. He is Chicago's greatest music photographer, Paul Natkin. Paul, thanks for joining us on WGN.
Nice to be here.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, sir. Like I said, I've seen your photographs all over the place. In fact, a quick story before we get started. At WCKG, this is like 98, your photographs, you know, huge on the wall, and then they started disappearing. People were taking them home, and I remember Harry Tynowitz said, oh, yeah, you get a free photo on your way out.
That's very nice of Harry to give away my photos. I always count on him.
There you go. I don't know if they ever caught the culprit or what the story was, but that's my story.
Well, that's a problem I have regularly. People have to screw them into the wall to keep them from being stolen.
Yeah, and that was done then, and they still vanished. I don't know how that happened.
Well, if you're there every day, you know what screwdriver to bring, and you know when to do it when nobody's around.
Let's start at the beginning with you. I love the story of how you got involved with making photography your life's work. It came from your father, right?
Right. He was a war photographer, and he came back to Chicago after the war, and a friend of his that was in the Army with him, Army Air Force, was the two of them decided to start a magazine, and they called the magazine Ebony Magazine.
Okay.
Because his friend was John Johnson from Johnson Publishing. So my father was the photographer for Ebony Magazine for the first 3 years of its existence, until they finally figured out that having a little short Jewish guy take pictures for a black magazine was kind of the wrong image that they were looking for. So he became a freelance photographer, and he did a bunch of jobs. He was the official photographer of the Chicago Housing Authority, the building of all the projects in Chicago.
Sure.
He was the Midwest guy for Life magazine and Look magazine. And then I was born in 1951. And my mother kind of intimated to him that it would probably be a good idea if he found another line of work, because he was never home.
Right.
And it's really hard to raise a family if you're not there.
Sure.
So he became a builder. Building contractor.
Okay.
And all the time I was growing up, I knew him as a building contractor, and definitely not as a photographer. Except there was this dark room in the basement, and there were a bunch of pictures on the wall, which I really didn't understand, but, you know, they were there. And then in the early 70s, he kind of went semi-bankrupt in the building business. He never declared bankruptcy, but there was no work. So he decided if he's not going to be making any money, he might as well do it being a photographer. So my mother got a job, and my father was home cooking dinner every night. But during the day, he got out his old cameras, and he just started walking around taking pictures and calling people that he knew back in the 50s. And one of them was a guy who was the publicist for this basketball team that nobody really cared about in Chicago called the Chicago Bulls.
Mm-hmm. They were new.
They were fairly new. They were like, you know, 2 years old. And nobody cared about them. You could walk up to the game 5 minutes before the game and buy really good tickets for like $5. So the guy said to him, the guy's name was Ben Bentley. And Ben Bentley said to him, well, you know, we'll give you a pass, and if you go in and get some good pictures, we'll buy them from you. So he came home the first night after the first game, and I was about 20 years old. I was still living at home with my parents. Had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And he said, well, we went to the game. free parking right next to the Chicago Stadium. Walked in the gate that the players come in. Got in for free. Went up to the press box. Got a free hot meal. And then I had the best seats in the house.
Not a bad deal.
And this light bulb went on over my head, like, you know, like in a cartoon. And I said, hey, teach me photography. I want to go. So the next game, he got an extra pass, and he took me. And here I was, you know, got the free parking, the free meal, got in for free, and I'm sitting right on the sidelines. Actually, we got there early, and I ended up playing basketball with the Bulls players.
Wow.
When they were warming up. And here I am, I'm 5'2", and I'm hanging out with guys that are 7 feet tall. I had no idea how to use a camera. I'd never held a camera in my hand in my life. So he pulled out an extra camera, and he showed me what to look through and how to focus and what button to push. And that's how I became a photographer.
That's incredible. And you started shooting concert photos. Remember, who was your first concert? Remember that?
Well, I branched out from shooting basketball to starting to shoot other sports.
Okay.
I shot a lot of tennis back in those days. This was in 1975, 76. And I was up at Northwestern in Evanston shooting a tennis match. And I got done. It was around dinner time. And I went back to my car, which was parked in a parking lot down the block, put the stuff in the trunk, and I got in the car, turned on the engine. Right as I turned on the engine, there was a commercial on the radio for a singer, guitar player that I kind of had heard of, because I was a big music fan in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Bonnie Raitt.
Okay.
And she was playing that night. And I couldn't make this up if it didn't actually happen. I was sitting in my car, staring at the wall of the venue that she was playing at.
Wow.
She was playing about 6 feet away from where I was sitting at that moment. So I figured, okay, I'm going to lie my way into this concert. Because I was pretty good at, you know, like telling people little white lies about, you know, why I should be there.
Sure.
In the sports world, and nobody really cared in those days. So I made up this huge lie about, there's this new magazine that had just started recently called Rolling Stone Magazine, and I was their Chicago photographer, and I had been hired to photograph Bonnie Raitt. So I shut off the engine, I got out, got my stuff out of the trunk, and I walked to the backstage door, and I opened the door, and I had my whole lie rehearsed. And before I could say anything, this guy looked at the camera hanging around my neck, and he said, oh, you're with the press. Go in and do whatever you want. Just don't get on stage.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, you know, there I am. This is my new career.
You mentioned Rolling Stone magazine. I want to talk about them just a little bit. Got to take a quick break here. I'm more with Paul Natkin, Chicago's photographer. Next, here at 720 WGN.
I don't believe it. Don't touch me. Hey, Ray. Hey, Sugar, tell them who we are.
Well, we're big rock singers. We got golden fingers, and we're loved everywhere we go.
That sounds like us.
We sing about beauty, and we sing about truth at $10,000 a show.
Right.
We take all kind of pills to give us all kind of thrills, but the thrill we've never known. It's the thrill that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see my picture on the cover?
Stone.
Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
Yes!
Stone. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
819, Phil Minicky for John Records, Landecker here at 720 WGN. We're talking with Chicago's music photographer, Paul Natkin. We heard Dr. Hook right there. You mentioned Rolling Stone magazine. Now, you worked for them, right?
I'm freelance, so I don't really work for any magazine.
Right.
I get assignments, freelance assignments, and they're one of my clients.
Got it. You also worked...
Not in the early days.
Right.
It took a lot to get to the point where they would hire me.
Oh, sure. I can imagine. You also worked for Cream... Circus, Hit Parader.
Yep, the Sun-Times, the Tribune, and many magazines around the world.
Right, and this is mostly in the 80s, right, when you got started?
started in the 70s, 75,
right.
76. What happened was one day, just on a whim, I decided to go to this place called the Ivanhoe Theater, which was a little theater on the corner of Clark and Wellington. It's now a Binney's liquor store. But in those days, it was the little concert facility in the city of Chicago.
Okay.
And like everybody that came through town played there. And I just, you know, I BS'd my way in the door by having all my equipment hanging around my neck. And they let me in and I shot. And as I was walking out, I walked by the dressing room door. And there was a guy sitting there, security guy. And he and I started talking. And he said, well, you know, who are you taking pictures for? And I said, really, nobody. I'm just trying to get a start. And he said, well, I have a feeling you might be pretty good. So I'm going to talk to my boss and see if I can get you a pass to come here anytime you want and come in and shoot pictures.
Wow.
And he did that. And I started shooting people like Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers, Cheech and Chong. The list of people that played at the Ivanhoe was pretty amazing.
Sure.
Including some people. I remember there was an opening act one night that was so bad that I didn't take any pictures of them because I figured they'd never amount to anything. They were called Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. But there were, you know, there was a show there every other night for about 5 years.
Sure.
And I went and shot them all. And I just started compiling this collection of photographs that I had no idea what to do with. I had no idea how to monetize them.
Right.
And then one day, my friend Scott Gelman, who's the guy who got me the pass, said, well, I'm going to talk to the guys that I work for. They're this company called Jam Productions. And let me see if I could get you access to all of our shows. And he did that, and all of a sudden I was shooting at everywhere from the Chicago Stadium down to Park West. And one night I was at Park West, there's a woman that I knew in the lobby, and she was standing talking to this guy, and she introduced me to him, and he was the art director slash photo editor of Cream Magazine, which was always one of my favorite magazines.
Sure.
So we traded cards, and he said, call me on the 15th of the month, and I'll give you a list of who we're doing articles about. And if we use any of your pictures, we'll pay you for them. So called him the 15th of the next month, gave me a list. I sent him a bunch of pictures, and one of them was a picture of Rick Derringer. And he used the picture of Rick Derringer, full page in the magazine, in color. And I'm thinking, man, I'm going to be a millionaire doing this. This is great. So about a week later, I got an envelope from Cream in the mail with a check in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I made $50.
Nice.
Which was way less than I thought I would make. But, you know, it was the first step on the ladder. So I got to the point after about a year where I was selling them 6 pictures every month on average. And I was still living with my parents. I still had a full-time day job working in a photo lab. And I was making some okay money.
Sure.
So I went and bought a copy of every rock and roll magazine on the newsstands. I took them all home with me. And one at a time, I started calling the photo editors who I found listed in the magazines.
Smart.
Eventually, they started doing the same thing. Call us in the middle of the month. We'll give you a list, send us photos. And pretty soon I had like 6 magazines that I was selling 5 pictures a month to. And no picture really got a lot of money for. I didn't get a lot of money for any of the pictures, but you add it all up and it became an income.
Sure.
And then one day I called my friend Charlie at Cream, and I said, okay, I've been doing this for a while. I want to shoot a cover for you. That's a whole different ball game. It's not just going to a concert. It's setting up a backdrop and lights. and shooting, you know, like an actual portrait of an artist or a band.
And you had never done that before, right?
No, I had no idea what I was doing. I've my whole career is built on doing things that I have no idea what I'm doing. And somehow finding my way through it.
Worked out pretty well for you, I gotta say.
Yeah, kind of. So the first cover I shot for them was a band called Rockpile.
Wow.
Do you know who they are?
Dave Edmonds, sure.
Dave Edmonds, Nick Lowe.
Yeah.
And two other guys. And I shot them for Cream. Came out on the newsstands, and man, I'm thinking, I finally made it. This is going to be great. And I think I got $200 for that picture.
A lot better than 50.
I spent more money on the background in the film
right?
than I got paid. But I had started to establish myself
sure.
as somebody who was professional and could get pictures into magazines.
Right.
And when I was shooting Rockpile, they were on Columbia Records, and the publicist from Columbia is the one that set up the job for me. Her name was Marilyn Laverty, and she called me up one day, and she said, listen, I've got an artist that's coming to Chicago, and Rolling Stone is doing an article about them, and I've recommended you to shoot the pictures.
Ooh.
And it was a girl. Her name was Rachel Sweet. She was from Ohio. She was kind of Britney Spears before Britney Spears was even born.
Okay.
She was 16 years old. She was on a record label called Stiff Records, which had Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe and Graham Parker and a bunch of people like that. And she was playing at this place called Beginnings.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a little venue out in Schaumburg.
Yeah.
In a strip mall that was owned by the drummer of the band Chicago. So I went out and shot pictures of Rachel Sweet, and Rolling Stone ran it, and I had a new client. But I also had a new friend, this publicist, Marilyn Laverty, who had another act that she worked with, a guy by the name of Bruce Springsteen.
Oh.
And she started calling me every time Bruce was in town, saying, you know, if you want to shoot, I could get you in. So I started shooting Bruce every time he came through town.
Wow.
And it's not hard to get good pictures of Bruce.
Right.
It's kind of a god of live performance.
Absolutely.
So here I am shooting bigger and bigger shows. And I didn't have a day job anymore. I had an apartment. I was like moving on up, so to speak.
Right.
And the early 80s came along, and I was shooting pictures every day.
Wow.
No matter who the band was. I was shooting everybody from Bruce Springsteen to Liberace, to Barry Manilow, to Marvin Gaye, to, you know, it didn't matter what kind of music it was.
Right.
I was shooting pictures of them. And 1984 came along, and I had photographed this guy from Minnesota. His name was Prince. I photographed him a couple times when he was in town, and I kind of knew the publicist, and one day she called me up, and she said, are you interested in going up to Minneapolis and photographing Prince's birthday party, which was June 7th of 1984? And it was right before Purple Rain came out.
Okay.
The movie and the album.
Sure.
Which both went to number one.
Yeah.
And he was going to play at his birthday party on stage. It was at First Avenue, which is the club that Purple Rain was filmed in.
Okay.
And he was going to play for the audience with the new band that he put together for the movie.
Sure.
And wear all the clothes that he wore in the movie.
Wow. Hold on one second, Paul. We got to take a break here. We're going to find out more about Prince's birthday party as shot by Paul Natkin after we check in with the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here at 720 WGN. Love speed jokes, by the way.
8:35, Phil Minnick for John Records, Landecker here at 720 WGN. We're talking with Chicago's music photographer, Paul Natkin. So, you're at Prince's birthday party.
I figured if I go up there, I'm going to be fighting off 100 other photographers.
Right.
Because if she's calling me, she's calling everybody.
Uh-huh.
But I figured it was worth it because in those days, this will show how old I am, you could buy a round-trip ticket from Chicago to Minneapolis for $100. So, okay, I'm going to risk $100 and hopefully maybe make that back. But it'll be a good experience.
Sure.
So I bought the ticket, got on the plane, got in a cab at the airport in Minneapolis, went to First Avenue, got to the door, and it was a private party. It wasn't open to the public. And there was a guest list that was like 30 pages long. So I walked up to the door. There's a guy sitting there with the guest list, and I said, I should be on the photographer's list. And he starts going through the 30 pages. And he finally comes to the last page. And at the top, it says, photographer, singular.
Really?
And there's one name on the page. So I have no idea to this day why they picked me. But I'm not complaining.
No.
So I walked in, I went up to the stage, found out that he was going on in about an hour. So I staked out a position right in front of his microphone. And I brought a book to read. So here I am at Prince's birthday party, and I'm reading a book, leaning against the front of the stage. So the house lights go down, and Prince walks on stage. He's standing about 4 feet away from me. And I just started shooting. He obviously knew that I was legitimate.
Right.
That I was invited.
Mm-hmm.
And he started posing for me on stage.
Oh, boy.
It was one of the most mind-blowing experiences of my life. He played for an hour, and I shot for the entire hour. The next morning, I got up, got a hotel room. Next morning, I got up, I flew home, got the film processed, and started sending it out to magazines.
Sure.
And one of the magazines I sent it to was Rolling Stone. And they picked three shots and ran. One of them was like half page. The other two were inside the magazine. You know, so right off the bat, I made more than $100 back.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, I get a call from my friend Marilyn, Springsteen's publicist. And she said, you know, I was just up at Rolling Stone. I saw your pictures of Prince, and I really liked them. Do you want to come back to Minneapolis and shoot the opening days of Bruce's Born in the USA tour?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, sure, $100 a ticket, a plane ticket, no problem. So she said, the show is on so-and-so date. It was like a week after Prince's birthday. Come a day early and call me when you get to the hotel. So I called her when I got to the hotel. She said, meet me in the lobby. And we went down to a rental car, and we went to the St. Paul Civic Center. And Bruce was shooting his first video ever of a song called Dancing in the Dark. And I don't know if you remember the video, but he grabs a girl from the audience and drags her up on stage.
That was Courtney Cox.
To dance with him,
yeah.
And it was Courtney Cox.
Right.
And the director of the video was Brian De Palma.
Oh, wow.
And it was an empty arena. They had about 100 people in an audience behind Bruce so they could shoot it so it looked like it was a sold-out show.
Sure.
And I had total access. I heard Dancing in the Dark about 30 times that day.
Sure.
But then Bruce just felt sorry for the audience behind him, so he just turned around and did like a half-hour set.
Wow.
That I was the only person there other than those people in the back. And it was pretty special.
Sure.
At lunch break, Courtney Cox sat down with me and we started talking. She was total nobody. She was a model.
Right.
From Alabama. And her uncle was a big music business guy. That's how she got the job.
Okay.
So we started talking and she was very nice. And from that day on, my pictures became valuable because they were pictures of Bruce, but then they became valuable because they were pictures of Courtney Cox.
Okay.
So they became doubly valuable.
Right.
I sent those pictures to Rolling. No, then I shot the first three nights of Springsteen's tour at the St. Paul Civic Center. And I got home, developed the film, sent them to Rolling Stone. They used a couple of those, like half page and full page, and paid off my plane ticket again. And then Rolling Stone called me up and said, we want to hire you to go down to Kansas City next week and photograph the opening of the Jackson 5's Victory Tour, which was the last time that they all performed together on stage.
Jeez.
I went down to Kansas City, spent 2 days there, shot two shows, and that was like my greatest month ever. June 7th to July 7th, 1984. After I got back from Bruce, before I went to the Jackson 5, he was playing two shows up at Alpine Valley.
Mm.
So I called my friend Marilyn and I said, hey, I want to go up to those two shows and shoot more. Because one thing I learned in this business is the more pictures you have, the better off you are.
Sure.
And if you shoot a bunch of shows, you got a bunch of pictures of them wearing different clothes.
Mm.
And you don't have a situation like earlier this week when the Sun-Times and the Tribune both had the exact same picture on the front page.
Mm.
So I shot the two shows at Alpine Valley, came back, put them all in my file, sold them all over the world. Because that album became, that and Prince's album became like the top two albums in the world.
They were huge.
And a year later, 1985, beginning of August, I got a call from Newsweek, who I'd worked with occasionally. I had sold them pictures for articles, you know, for $150 a piece here and there. And they said, hey, you know, Marilyn Laverty called and said that you have great pictures of Springsteen. Can we see him? Because we're looking to do a big article about him. Because he had switched from playing hockey arenas to playing football stadiums.
Right.
So I sent him a bunch of stuff, figuring maybe I'll get a picture in the article. And they called me up the next day and said, well, we've narrowed the cover shot down to three shots. And one of them is a guy from California, and the other two are yours.
Nice.
So we're making a last-minute decision, but we just want to know if your picture is used on the cover, what do you want your photo credit to read as? So I told them, still figuring, okay, my odds are two out of three, but with my luck, it'll be the other guy that gets the cover. And the following Monday morning, I get a call saying, you got the cover in Newsweek.
Wow.
So I was living in Lakeview at the time, and my next-door neighbor was the music critic of the Chicago Sun-Times.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me up and he said, hey, I just heard your picture was on the cover of Newsweek. I want to do an article about you for the paper.
Mm.
So he came over, interviewed me for a little article. He brought a photographer with him who took a picture of me standing against the wall holding up Newsweek with my picture on the cover.
Cool.
And it appeared in the paper later that week. And I got a call that day from this, there was a talk show in Chicago called AM Chicago. It was on Channel 7 at 9 o'clock in the morning. It was a live talk show. And they were doing a show called Brushes with Bruce. And it was all people that had some kind of connection with Springsteen. So I went on the show. The regular host was this woman you might have heard of. Her name was Oprah Winfrey.
Mm.
But she wasn't there because she was filming The Color Purple at the time.
Okay.
So her substitute host for the day was Mary Lou Henner from Taxi.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on the show live with some of the craziest people I've ever met in my life. There was a woman whose whole claim to fame was, the last time Bruce was in town, he had played at the Rosemont Horizon, and she was the one that went and got his dirty dishes out of his dressing room and washed them. And then my friend Don, the Sun-Times critic, was there because he had gone to Washington, D.C. to review the first show of the tour. And I was there, and I sat there for an hour on live TV and never said a word.
Really?
Because It was so embarrassing to be around like somebody who washed Bruce's dishes that I couldn't think of anything to say, so I just sat there.
I want to hear more about Oprah. That's coming up next here at 720 WGN. We're with Paul Natkin. Phil Manikian for John Records, Landecker here at 720 WGN. Talking with Chicago's music photographer, Paul Natkin. If you're just joining us, he talked about touring a little bit with Bruce Springsteen. Also, the Jackson 5. His photo was on the cover of Newsweek. And we started talking about AM Chicago. So that's where we're at. You're on the TV show AM Chicago. The theme is Brushes with Bruce Springsteen, and you're like almost embarrassed, right?
Actually embarrassed.
You deserve to be there, though.
Well, yeah, true, but what am I going to say to people that are all oohing and aahing over somebody that washed Bruce's dishes?
Right.
So I got up to leave at the end of the show, and I took my microphone off and laid it on the chair, and I'm walking out the door, and this woman walks up to me and says, "Hey, do you have a business card?" And I said, "Sure." And I gave her a business card. She said, "Well, we might need you to take pictures in the future." And I said, "Sure, give me a call, no problem." Mm-hmm. And having no idea what she was talking about, because I had never even heard of Oprah Winfrey at the time.
Right.
And she wasn't even there. So at that point, if you would have said the name Oprah Winfrey, I would have just looked at you with my head cocked to the side like, "Who's that?"
Well, just like everyone else, really.
Yeah. I mean, she was fairly popular in Chicago when she was on AM Chicago.
Right.
But I didn't watch morning TV. So I go home, don't think anything of it. And the following year, at the beginning of September, I get a call from this woman who it turned out was the executive producer of AM Chicago, who then became the executive producer of the Oprah Winfrey Show. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Hey, you know, our show is going national in a month, and we're going to need a photographer." And the way she put it, I'll never forget this. She said, "I'm sure you're not interested, but do you know anybody that might be?"
Really?
Because, you know, it's kind of boring to take pictures at a TV show. But, and you know, the host is somebody I didn't even know anything about.
Right.
The only real talk show in America was the Phil Donahue Show at that time. So I said, "Well, you know, let me think about it. Let me come down and meet with you." And I went and met with her, and I thought about it. And I really pride myself on being a really good businessman. And I know the business of photography.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the business of owning the pictures that I take, as opposed to working for somebody and having them take over ownership. I want to try this thing out. I said, "I'll give you a really good price, but I want to own the copyright to everything that I shoot." So Phil Donahue was, you know, tremendously successful. And his people used to call me every once in a while with just these weird requests like, "Hey, you know, Dolly Parton's going to be on the show. Do you want to come and hang out and take some pictures?" Or the Bee Gees, or, you know, something like that. And I used to go over there because it was right near where I lived. So I figured if Oprah's going to compete with Phil Donahue, she's going to have famous people on her show. And if she has famous people on the show and I own those pictures, this could be another way, another income stream.
Right.
So I made a deal to shoot the shows, and I started going down there probably on average two or three times a week, and taking tons of pictures of this woman who was really not very famous at the time, but became famous pretty quickly.
Right.
And, you know, she was a friend at the time. She used to come over to my house and watch Bears games. You know, she'd flip burgers on the grill on the back porch. And, you know, she was a regular person. And then she...
How cool are you?
Then she became Oprah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it got really weird over there.
I can imagine. You were there for 5 years.
Yeah.
Now, I have to... This is a perfect spot to bring this up. You were gone. You weren't working with Oprah anymore. But it was 2010. I think you may have seen it. Everyone has on YouTube when Drew Brees, he just won the Super Bowl, comes on Oprah. Oprah's crazy. Oh, you're here. Fantastic. And she goes over to him and says, who just kissed you? And she wipes his face off.
Wow.
Of his birthmark. I guarantee you three people got fired right then and there for not letting her know what had happened. It was so embarrassing, but it's out there on YouTube. You got to check it out.
Yeah, I'm going to check that out.
Yeah.
But, you know, that just proves my theory, which is that the people that were working for her, in spite of the fact that they really didn't know what they were doing, she became very famous. It's a testimonial to her fame,
right,
that she could overcome the fact that most of the people that work for her were not really professional TV people.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't want to go into details about that, but that could be another 3 hours of conversation. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah. Let's move on to something else that you got involved with, which was kind of a big name in rock and roll, Keith Richards. How did Keith Richards come about?
Well, in the middle of the whole Oprah thing,
yeah,
you know, I was there quite often, and I, you know, it was something to do in the morning, and I was shooting concerts all the time. And my neighbor, the Sun Times guy, his name is Don McLeese, called me up one day. This is 3 years after the Newsweek cover.
Okay.
Called me up one day, and he said, "Hey, you know, I'm going to New York tomorrow to interview Keith Richards. Do you want to come along and take pictures?" And, you know, at that point, pretty much if somebody asked me to go to Uzbekistan, I'd have my credit card out buying a plane ticket the next 10 minutes.
Right.
So now going to New York, it wasn't a $100 round trip. It was a $500 round trip.
Yeah.
When you buy the ticket, the day before you're flying. So I said, sure, no problem. So the next morning we got up, we went to the airport, got on a plane, went to New York, checked into the hotel, and we went over to Keith's manager's office. And I set up a little studio with some lights and a background in the corner while Don got ready to interview Keith. And by the way, just as an aside, Keith is the only idol that I have in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So here I am, you know, my hands are shaking.
Sure.
You know, I got everything set up and ready to go, and he walks in the door, and it could have been really bad. You know, I mean, I can't even begin to list the number of people that I admired that turned out to be total jerks.
Sure, sure.
And if Keith would have turned out to be a total jerk, I would have gotten really depressed.
Yeah.
But he ended up being the nicest guy on the planet.
Hold on 1 second. I got to take a break here. I want to hear more about Keith. I'm a Stones guy as well. We're talking with Chicago's music photographer, Paul Natkin. That's after we check in with the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here at 720 WGN. All right. I want you to listen to the words to this, because it's Keith talking about Mick and their relationship at the time.
The feeling.
10 minutes past 9 o'clock. Phil Minicky for John Records, Landecker at 720 WGN. Talking with Chicago's music photographer, Paul Natkin. So you meet Keith Richards.
So I did this little photo shoot with him. And the whole thing was 5 minutes. And I packed up my stuff. And while I was doing it, Don was interviewing him across the room. And this is when his first solo album came out.
Right.
It's Expensive Winos. It's called Talk Is Cheap.
Him and Mick were not on the best of terms.
No, they were. That's an understatement.
Yeah.
So I heard him say to Don said to him, "Well, are you going to tour to promote this album?" And he said, "Yeah, we're going to put the band together that's on the album, and we're going to do a tour in November." So I just filed that in the back of my head. Packed up my stuff. We went back to the hotel. We checked out, got on a plane, came back to Chicago. And I developed the film, made a bunch of prints, sent a bunch of them down to the Sun-Times, and I made a second copy of everything. Mm-hmm. And I sent it to his manager in New York with a little two-line note that said, "Hey, I heard you guys are going out on tour. If you need a photographer, let me know." I didn't even take it to the post office. I put some stamps on the envelope and put "Do Not Bend" on the envelope and threw it in the mailbox on the corner, figuring there's no way that they're ever going to call me.
Mm-hmm.
And the day before Thanksgiving of that year, I get a call from Keith's manager, and she says, "Hey, what are you doing tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, you know, I was planning to go to my mother's house for Thanksgiving."
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "No, get up in the morning, pack your stuff up, fly to Atlanta, come to the Ritz-Carlton, and call me when you get here."
You have got to be over the moon.
So, yeah, I called my mother and said, "Hey, guess what? I'm not coming for dinner." And I went to Atlanta, met him, shot the show that night, got on the tour bus, drove to Memphis, I think it was, and I did 3 weeks on the road with him.
And you lived to tell it.
It was fairly tame. There's nowhere near the debauchery that there was back in the 60s.
Sure.
There's way too much money involved.
Right.
So we did everything from, you know, New Jersey to San Francisco to L.A. to New York to Chicago to Detroit. And it was a blast. It was the first time I'd ever been on the road. You know, like for a length of time with a rock band.
Yeah.
So I get home. It's right around the last day of the tour was Keith's birthday in the Meadowlands in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Which is December 19th. So I go home. It's like 5 days before Christmas. And the first issue of 1989 Rolling Stone is in my mailbox when I get home.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little thing in random notes that says that Mick and Keith had a meeting and gotten together and decided to bury their differences. And the Stones were going out on tour in 1989.
And a light bulb goes off in Paul Natkin's head.
Over my head, not in my head. So I wrote the same note that I wrote to Keith's manager. And I said, "Hey, I heard you guys are going out on the road. Let me know if you need a photographer."
Worked before, didn't it?
The same thing happened. I got a call. The tour started, and nobody had called me. And I'm thinking, well, you know, it was a good try.
Yeah.
But I had my pinnacle of my life was being on the road for 3 weeks with Keith.
Sure.
And actually becoming friends with him, you know, to the point where I go to his house in Connecticut. And, you know, how can it get any better than that?
Yeah.
There's only one thing that could be better than that, and that's touring with the Rolling Stones. So the tour starts, no calls from anybody, and I figure, okay, you know, Keith is the pinnacle of my life. And about 3 weeks into the tour, I get a call from Keith's manager, and she says, hey, what are you doing tomorrow?
You love those phone calls.
If this is anything like the last time you called me, I guess I'm coming to meet you somewhere.
That's awesome.
And she said, get up in the morning, fly to Boston, get in a cab, come to the Ritz-Carlton, call me when you get here. And the next day, I get up in the morning, fly to Boston, go to the hotel, drop off my luggage with the luggage guy on the tour, and an hour later, I'm in a van with the Rolling Stones going out to Foxborough,
jeez,
which is the football stadium where the Patriots used to play.
Right.
And a couple hours later, I'm shooting my first Rolling Stones show, jeez, from on stage.
Nice.
And the show's over. We all get in a bunch of vans. We go out at the airport, and we get on a private jet, and we fly to Birmingham, Alabama. So I woke up in Chicago, flew to Boston, shot a Stones show, got on a plane, flew to Birmingham, Alabama. That's one day.
Life on the road with the Stones, baby.
So that I hadn't even made a deal with them yet.
Really?
Like, there was no time to sit down and talk business.
Sure.
So they told me the next day, we got up at the hotel. We had a couple days off in Birmingham. We got up, and we had a meeting, and they said, we want you to shoot a month on the road. Okay, no problem.
Not bad.
So, now, I was still working for Oprah at the time.
Oh.
And I told her that I wasn't going to be gone for long.
Okay.
You know, I'm still with you, but I got to go and do this.
Yeah.
And she was okay with it. So, 3 weeks into the month, we had already done three nights at the Coliseum in Los Angeles with Guns N' Roses opening the shows. We had done four nights at Shea Stadium in New York. And on the morning of the fourth New York show, I get a call from Keith's manager, and she said, hey, can you come up to my room? And I figured, okay, what did I do wrong?
Uh-oh.
That's like being sent to the principal's office.
Right. I want to find out what happened next. I've got so many more questions for you, too. Paul Natkin here at 720 WGN. 20 minutes past 9 o'clock. Phil Minikian for John Records Landecker at 720 WGN. We're talking with Chicago's music photographer, Paul Natkin. So you get called up to Keith Richards' tour manager's office.
And I knock on her door, and the door opens, and she's sitting there in a room with Mick Jagger's manager and the publicist on the tour. So it's like being called into the Supreme Court.
Right.
And I'm thinking, okay, since I'm done with this, I go and pack my stuff and I go home because I must have done something really bad.
Right.
And I walk in, I sit down in one of the beds, and they say, you know what? We have a problem. Uh-oh. And I said, what? And they said, the band really likes you. We love your work. And you can't just do a month. You've got to do the whole tour.
Wow.
Which ended up being an additional 2.5 months.
Wow.
And so I did 3.5 months on the road with Stones in 89.
Jeez.
And I came back, and my whole world had changed.
Sure.
I got anything that I wanted from any publicist in the music business.
You're Mr. Big Shot now.
Yeah. I never really came out and said that, but it's like, hey, I made a point to, when we were in New York, I called all my friends who were all publicists, just innocently saying, you know, hey, I'm in town with the Stones. You want to go out to lunch? Just so they would know what I was doing.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
That's and awesome. So that in 93, Keith did a second solo tour. He had an album called The Main Offender.
Yeah.
I did that one. I did about a month on that one. And at this point, Oprah was now introducing me to her audience as, this is my photographer, Paul Natkin, and he also works for the Rolling Stones.
Nice.
So, and then 94, they started the Voodoo Lounge Tour.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody called me. I'm thinking, okay, I'm just going to, you know, I've done everything I could do in my life. And then 3 weeks into that tour, they called me and asked me to do 2 months on the road on that tour.
Jeez. Let's fast forward. You work on the Bridges to Babylon tour as well with the Rolling Stones. Those had to be
That was a different kind of thing. At that point, they finally figured out that they really didn't need anybody every night.
Okay.
Because they do the same show every night.
Sure.
The lights are the same. For the most part, the clothes are the same. And it really gets kind of boring.
Okay.
So the Bridges to Babylon tour started in Chicago. So I did, they set up at Soldier Field, and I did 3 nights of rehearsals with them, where they basically played to an empty stadium, and I walked around on stage, I did anything I wanted. And then they played at the Double Door.
Right, right.
And they called me up, and I probably shouldn't even tell this story because this really doesn't make me look all that great, but I'm going to tell it anyway. They called me up and said, meet us at the Double Door. We're playing there tonight. And I said, I don't want to meet you at the Double Door. I want to come down to the hotel and ride to the Double Door with the band. Because
wow.
I wanted to get out of the van in front of the Double Door with the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. How cool is that?
So we pull up on Milwaukee Avenue, and Keith gets out, holds the door open for me to get out after him.
Stop it.
And he puts his arm around my shoulder, and we walk into the Double Door together.
Oh, my goodness. That's
and that
awesome.
Totally cemented me as being the guy if you need something in Chicago.
That's so cool. That's so cool. Chicago's music photographer, Paul Natkin, that's who we're talking to.
It cost me $75 to park at the Ritz-Carlton, but it was worth it.
I have to ask you, what's your most famous photo, would you think?
My most famous photo I took in 1982, Super Bowl Sunday. I was hired to photograph a guy named Don Airey, who was a keyboard player for Ozzy Osbourne.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, Don Airey was not on stage during the show. The stage was a giant castle, and he was up in one of the turrets of the castle.
Okay.
So I couldn't go to the show and shoot him because you couldn't see him. So the publicist said, why don't you come to soundcheck? And while they're doing soundcheck, just walk up the stairs in the castle and go up there and shoot him up there. So I did that, and all I could think of was I got to get done so I could get home in time to watch the Super Bowl, because I'm a big sports fan.
Mm-hmm.
So I get done, I pack up my stuff, and I'm ready to leave, and the publicist was standing there, and he said, well, where are you going? And I didn't want to say to him, like, I could care less about Ozzy Osbourne. I want to go and watch the Super Bowl.
Sure.
And he starts laughing, and he says, I know you want to go and watch a football game, but why don't you stay and watch it backstage with us and then shoot Ozzy's show? So in those days, the Super Bowl was on really early. It's like 4:00 in the afternoon.
Okay.
So the Super Bowl was over at 7:00, and Ozzy came on stage, and I'm shooting away, and I'm getting good pictures. It's, you know. And Ozzy's running around like a maniac on stage.
This is 1982, and, Ozzy. Let's keep this in mind.
Yeah. I don't think he could do that now. I see this little guitar player. It's a little blonde guy with a polka dot guitar. And I figure rather than following Ozzy around, I'm going to take some pictures of this guy. Maybe he'll become famous one day. So I'm taking pictures of the guitar player, and Ozzy comes running back to our side of the stage, and he picks the guitar player up in the air and holds him up over his head.
Mm-hmm.
And I took two pictures, and he put them down, and then I just continued shooting. Didn't think anything of it. Didn't even know who the guitar player was. So I finish up the show. I go home, develop the film. I got a really nice picture of him holding the guitar player, his name was Randy Rhodes, holding him up in the air. And about a month later, I pick up the newspaper and read that Randy Rhodes has died in a plane crash.
Right.
And at that point forever, I think there were only three photographers in the world that had ever shot pictures of Randy Rhodes.
Really?
And I was one of them, and my picture is better than anybody else's.
That's your most famous photo right there.
So that picture has been on, without exaggeration, 30 magazine covers.
Wow.
At least three book covers that I can remember. It's been a billboard on Sunset Boulevard.
Jeez.
It's my favorite one was last year. They made a company in Vancouver made a limited edition Ozzy and Randy snowboard.
Really?
And my picture is on the snowboard.
Wow.
And Sharon Osbourne introduces me as, this is the guy that took the picture of Ozzy and Randy.
Very cool.
And everybody knows me as that.
Yeah. What kind of camera have you used? It's a Nikon, right?
Well, in the old days, there were Nikon's film cameras.
Right.
You know, and I used to carry like three cameras and about six lenses. Well, now it's all digital.
Right.
And they're also Nikons at this point.
Yeah.
But I only have three lenses because they're all zoom lenses now.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, always Nikon.
Yeah.
From the beginning.
All right, hold on, Paul, 1 second. We've got more with Paul Natkin after this update from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here at 720 WGN. 9:35, Phil Minnick in for John Records, Landecker on 720 WGN. We're talking with Chicago's music photographer, Paul Natkin. All right, here's the deal. I'm going to give you a phrase, and I want your reaction to it. You can't use that.
My reaction to that? You mean like you can't use that picture?
Right.
Usually people don't see my pictures before they go out.
Okay.
So they have to trust me that my pictures are going to be good, and there are very few people in the music business that don't trust me. I've kind of built a reputation of not sending out bad pictures.
Right.
If somebody does something really stupid on stage, or if their hair is, you know, all greasy, or if my favorite one was my friend Belinda Carlisle from the Go-Go's.
Okay.
She did a solo tour 1 year, and so I went and did a photo shoot with her backstage at Poplar Creek, and then she said, well, of course, you could shoot the whole show. Most photographers, they only let you shoot the first 15 minutes.
Right. First three songs.
Yeah. So she said, well, you could shoot the whole show. So I found a seat right in the front row, and she gets up on stage, and in the middle of the second song, her makeup starts running down the sides of her face.
Uh-oh.
And I stopped shooting. But I really like her, so I stayed and watched the show. And I'm just sitting there in the front row watching the show, and she keeps on looking at me like, why aren't you shooting? And then she walks off stage for the encore, and she comes back, and all that makeup had been wiped off.
Sure.
So I went backstage afterwards, and she just looked at me and shook her head and said, thank you.
There you go. Very nice. The one that I was thinking of you can't use that, involved Guns N' Roses. This is later on. When Axl got a little bit fat, right?
I never shot him when he was fat. I only really shot them twice. One time they were opening for Alice Cooper at the UIC Pavilion. And their publicist called me up and said, hey, you know, you got to shoot this band that's the opening act because they're going to be really big one day.
Okay.
So I did a photo shoot with them. And, you know, they were relatively nice, some nicer than others, but nothing special.
Yeah.
Didn't even shoot them live that night. And then one night they opened for Aerosmith out of Poplar Creek, and I went and shot them live. And that's really the only time I ever shot the real Guns N' Roses live.
Got it.
I shot the Axl Rose with Buckethead and that tour where Best Buy paid him a lot of money to do a tour, and then he didn't deliver an album.
Right, right, right.
I shot that show, but I guess he was kind of fat in those days, but I never really thought about it. At that point, the pictures of him were kind of not worth much anymore.
Yeah. Some more phrases to throw at you, or just concepts. Your thoughts on paparazzi. They kind of ruin it for you, don't they?
They kind of ruin it for every photographer on the planet.
Yeah.
They've made it so that photographer is a bad word.
Right.
And it's for that reason that about middle 80s, they started restricting what I do for a living.
Mm.
The first rule that came about was you can only shoot the first three songs.
Mm-hmm.
The second rule was, hey, you have to shoot from the soundboard, which is impossible.
Right.
And then the third rule was, to get this photo pass, you have to sign a contract.
Mm.
And the contract says, they all use the same contract.
Yeah.
Every band that's out there today. You can shoot pictures, but they can only go to one magazine.
Really?
Which means that no matter what I do, I lose money on the job.
Right.
Because magazines don't pay anymore, if there even are magazines anymore.
Yeah.
So you have to fill in the contract, what the magazine is that you're working for.
Mm-hmm.
You can't give any pictures to agencies. Like, I'm with Getty Images, and people from all over the world license my photographs by finding them on Getty. But if I sign that contract, I'm not allowed to give them to Getty.
Right.
And then the third rule, which is the one that I hate more than anything, and this goes back to the discussion about Oprah back in the middle of this conversation,
right,
is after you sell your one picture to the magazine that you've listed, all the photographs become our property.
Right, right.
And we own the copyright to everything.
Jeez.
And now, first of all, there's no reason that anybody in their right mind would ever sign that contract.
Yeah.
If they intended to actually live by it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just stopped shooting. And I could tell you, 10 years ago, in a given year, I would shoot 300 bands in a year.
Jeez.
Most weeks, I would be out shooting five nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
This year, of course, there's nothing.
Right.
But that's for a different reason.
Yeah.
In 2019, I shot seven bands total.
That's it.
And those were the bands that know me and trust me.
Sure.
And don't make me sign a contract.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And one of them is Buddy Guy, who I go, when he plays in January, he plays the whole month of January at his club.
Right.
And I go to all 16 shows. One of them is any form of members of the Black Crowes,
mm-hmm.
who are all my friends. So whenever Chris Robinson comes to town with his band, he'll call me that morning and say, hey, you coming down to the show tonight? And I have to be careful what I say because at that point I have no idea that he's even in town. And I'll say, yeah, sure, put my name on the list. And I'll go and shoot. Mm-hmm. Rich Robinson does the same thing.
Okay.
Steve Gorman, who's the drummer, does the same thing. And I go and shoot them all the time. Just because they're my friends.
Right.
And I love sitting backstage and telling stories with them.
That's cool.
And that's pretty much it. I shoot a bunch of little bands that nobody's ever heard of.
Mm-hmm. I think I know the answer to this question. The coolest guy you've met? It's got to be Keith.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How about not so cool guy?
Not so cool?
Yeah.
Have you got about an hour? I can honestly say there are only two guys that I've ever photographed that don't like me.
Okay.
My list of people I photographed is over 4,000 names.
Wow.
And there's two guys that I don't get along with.
Okay.
One of them is Billy Corgan.
Okay.
And one of them is John Mellencamp.
Really?
Yeah.
It's not because of the photo you took of him? It was on Michigan Avenue with a garbage pail?
Oh, no, he loves that picture.
That's great.
Yeah.
You got to check that.
That is right in front of. Are you at the studio on Michigan Avenue? That's right in front of the window of your studio.
Okay. Now we're in a different building now, but I know where that is.
Oh, okay. Well, when the studio was on Michigan Avenue.
Yeah.
He was staying at the Intercontinental.
Okay.
And we just went walking down the street, and he dove into the garbage can.
Oh, that's funny.
It's a long story. But you know, we probably shouldn't go into it on the radio.
You've photographed everywhere. Do you have a favorite venue?
For quality of the final product,
yeah,
it would have to be the Riviera, because the stage is really low.
Sure.
And you're shooting right up into the lights, so you get all that cool, those cool colors in the background.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite venue of all time is the Aragon. It's the perfect rock and roll venue.
We talked about the paparazzi before. What about the advent of cell phone cameras?
Well, those don't really bother me. I mean, you know, people in the audience can do anything they want.
Right.
You know, I don't understand why they shoot pictures. I don't understand why they pay $100 for a ticket and spend the whole time taking pictures that are going to be really kind of mediocre.
Right.
That they're probably never going to look at again.
Mm-hmm.
But what really gets me is when there are 10 photographers in the photo pit, and we all have the same passes on, the same access, and 5 out of 10 of them are shooting with iPhones.
Jeez.
It kind of, what's the word? It diminishes the act.
Sure.
Of what I do.
We're going to wrap things up with Chicago's premier music photographer, Paul Natkin. That's next. It's 720 WGN. Phil Manicki in for John Records Landecker here at 720 WGN. Talking with Chicago's premier music photographer, Paul Natkin. We touched on this a little earlier in the evening, but I want to hear the story about the artist who was on your side in the first 3 songs rule.
Man, you did your research. So I was shooting this band at the Riviera called Young the Giant. They're fairly popular. I mean, they went from the Riviera to the... They played Northerly Island the next time they came to town and sold 8,000 tickets. So,
wow.
You know, they're fairly well known.
Yeah.
And I was hired by the microphone company that gave them their microphones. And they wanted me to shoot toward the encore. The lead singer switched to a different microphone.
Okay.
And it was the microphone that they wanted the pictures of. So it was at the end of the show. So I go to the show, I go backstage, go downstairs, and the road manager hands me a photo pass and says, you could only shoot the first 3 songs. And there's about 4 of us standing around the hallway. And I looked at the guy and I said, well, how am I going to get pictures of the microphone that I'm supposed to be shooting if it's at the end of the show?
Right.
And he looks at me and says, well, I guess you're out of luck.
Really?
And then there was this guy standing next to me, and he said, why do we only let people shoot the first 3 songs?
Yeah.
And the road manager says, I don't know. And I said to him, well, listen, all you got to do is give me permission to shoot the whole show and just tell the security guys, and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
This is what I do for a living.
Right.
And he said, well, I can't do that. That's the, you know, it's the rules of the venue. And I said, no, it's not the rules of the venue. It's a rule that you guys made up.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, well, you know, I'm going to have to ask the promoter. And I said, okay, let's go down to his office. He's right down the hallway. And we walked over to the promoter's office, and my friend Nick Miller is sitting in the office. And the road manager says, this guy tells me that you'll be okay if he shoots the whole show. And Nick looks at me, and he looks at the guy, and he says, he can do anything he wants.
Nice.
So the guy lets me shoot the whole show. I got great pictures. I send them to his manager the next morning, the band's manager. And they call me. The guy calls me up from New York, and he says, how did you get those pictures? And I said, well, the reason I got those pictures is that I was the only photographer there at the end of the show when all the good stuff happens.
Right.
And he said, and I said, all the other photographers were probably already at home on their couch watching the news.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, why do we let people only shoot the first three songs? And I said, you shouldn't. You should let people shoot the whole show. And he said something to me that has been burned into my brain forever.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, you make too much money off of us.
Really?
And I was sitting in front of my computer, and I had my latest Getty sales report
uh-huh.
on my desktop. I said, give me your email address. I'm going to send you my latest sales report. I just want you to look at it. And I sent it off to him. He got it a minute later, or 30 seconds later. And I said, okay, open it up and look at the final column, which is what I make from every sale. And he looked at it, and there was dead silence at the other end of the line. And he said, he used four words. One of them I can't say on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
The first word is, oh. The second word is my. The third word is can't say.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth word is God.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, let's sit down and have a phone conversation, and let's set it up so that you guys could go around the country and let everybody shoot the whole show. And he did that.
Really?
And the next time they came through town, there were 10 photographers there, and the road manager came out and met with us and said, okay, thanks to him, and pointed at me, everybody gets to shoot the whole show.
Wow. You're a hero.
Now, I have no idea. This was 4 years ago.
Okay.
I have no idea if they still do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the way it works. Can I tell you one more story?
Go ahead, please.
So in 1999, don't ask me how this happened because it's too long a story to tell, I became Brian Wilson's road manager.
Mm.
And we go out on the road, and one of my jobs as the road manager is to have a meeting with the head of security for the venue.
Okay.
And my job is to tell him, like, who gets to go backstage, what kind of passes they should wear. And one of the things we talk about is what the photographers get to do. And I had a meeting with Brian's manager, and I said, listen, if I'm going to be the road manager, everybody gets to shoot the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
And she laughed, and she said, yeah, go ahead, no problem.
Really?
Yeah, because she knows me, and she knew I was going to ask that. And Brian doesn't do anything on stage. He
right.
almost never moves whatsoever.
Yeah.
So the first night, we're in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I meet with the head of security. He's an ex-football player who's about 2 feet taller than me and weighs about 100 pounds more than me. And he says, okay, what are you going to do about photographers?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, we do things a little differently here. All photographers that have photo passes get to shoot the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody in the audience with a camera gets to shoot whatever they want.
Wow.
As long as they don't use a flash.
Okay.
And the guy looks at me and he says, sorry, can't do it.
Really?
And I looked at him, and here I have to look up at him. I'm looking, it's like I'm looking up at the John Hancock building.
Uh-huh.
And I look up at him, I said, well, you know, sorry, it's my show, and you got to follow my rules.
Yeah.
And he says, nope, not going to do it. And we went round and round for about 5 minutes, and finally I said, okay, why don't you call the theater manager and get him back here? So he picks up the house phone, he calls the theater manager, and at this point, the theater manager has got so many things to do right before the doors open. The last thing he has to do is deal with some maniac road manager who wants everybody to shoot the whole show. But he came backstage, and the security guy says, points to me and says, this guy tells me that he wants everybody to photograph the whole show. And the theater manager looks at him, he says, it's his show.
Nice.
And this happened. I did 60 dates with Brian over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
This happened, without exaggeration, 30 out of the 60 times.
Wow. Amazing.
And I won every time.
A couple more quick questions. The weirdest moment or request that you had. You don't have to use names.
I had a girl that called me up once. She was a performer. And she said, I want to come over to your house, take off my clothes, and set myself on fire.
All right.
Can you take pictures of it?
Okay.
And I said, come on over. And she rubbed rubbing alcohol on her arms and then lit it on fire.
Uh-huh.
And I photographed her. And it, all it does is it burns the alcohol off, and then the flames go out.
Okay.
And then she said, how about if I blow some fireballs across the room? So I said, sure, go ahead. And she put some rubbing alcohol in her mouth, and she lights a torch, and she blows the alcohol through the torch, and it sets up a fireball across the room. Could have burned down my whole house, but it was fun.
Speaking of fun, you like fun. Who is the top, as far as fun is concerned, who you've shot over the years?
Well, of course, it's the Stones and Springsteen.
Sure.
But it's mostly heavy metal bands.
Really?
Hair metal bands from the 80s.
Okay.
Those guys, they knew how to do lighting. They knew how to do clothing and hairspray and all that stuff. There, you could not stop shooting them.
Yeah.
Bon Jovi is a perfect example.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I shot him from every show that he ever did in the city of Chicago, from the beginning of the show to the end, and never stopped because he does so many great things on stage.
Yeah. With all this experience, all these people you've shot, you really haven't written a book. You got together.
It's coming out in about 4 months.
Really? That goes with my next question of what are you doing next? Really? Talk to me about the book.
Well, it's not like I'm writing a book. I'm not telling a whole lot of stories. It's almost all pictures.
As it should be.
And it's about 95% laid out. It was supposed to be out for this Christmas.
Yeah.
But because of the pandemic, you know.
Right.
It's really hard to edit and lay out a book over Zoom calls.
Yeah.
But all the pictures have been picked. I tell a bunch of stories in it. I've got Buddy Guy, some quotes from Buddy Guy. I got some quotes from Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick. Some quotes from Steve Gorman from the Black Crowes. And it's like 99% pictures.
Oh, man. I cannot wait to see that. Paul Natkin, Chicago's premier music photographer. Paul, thank you so much. Thanks also to Ron Onesti of the Arcata Theater in St. Charles, and so much more. He's got a lot going on. Keep an eye out for the Desplaines Theater, too. If you didn't know about that, we may have learned about that tonight. Thanks to our producer tonight, Ben Anderson, our engineer, Bob Ferguson. Thanks, as always, to Ashley Byhun and Dave Plyer. Appreciate that. We learned a bit about the opening of the economy. We're going to hear more on that later in the week. With small business owners. We learned about picture taking from the best in Chicago, Paul Natkin. I think we got to have Paul back. Man, there are so many great stories. If you enjoyed our conversations tonight, I'd really appreciate it if you let the powers that be here at WGN know that. I'm Phil Minicky. Thanks so much for being here tonight. Thanks for all your kind words, your phone calls. I'll be back Wednesday evening for John Records Landecker. Rowley James next. That's after an update from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here at 720 WGN.